It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As a citizen of the Bad River Ojibwe tribe in northern Wisconsin, Bernice Rabideau was just 5 years old when she and her siblings were separated from their parents. They were sent to St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School in Odena, a small community on the Bad River Reservation. It was 1930. She wouldn't see her mother again for 2 years.
Bernice's daughter, journalist Mary Annette Pember, has researched the history of Indian boarding schools and the toll that it took on her mother and family.
Over nearly a century, at least 1,000 Native American children died in these schools. It's caused generations of trauma on Native communities. And as a warning, this conversation contains disturbing details of violence.
Pember's new book is called Medicine River, A Story of Survival and the Legacy of Indian Boarding Schools. She is a national correspondent for ICT News and a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Mary, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Great to be here.
Your mother, Bernice, was just 5 when she was sent to St. Mary's. And to think that her younger brother was only 3, was this normal for children to be taken from their parents and forced to go to these schools so young?
You know, in some cases, yes. Actually, by the time my mother went, you know, which was is in the 30s, they had, generally speaking, actually realized that sending children so young was not necessarily a great idea. My mother and her siblings, however, were in a situation where both their parents were no longer available to raise them, and that contributed to their being sent to the sister school, to the boarding school.
Can you put into words what this separation was like for these children early on?
Well, you know, they really didn't know what was going on. I mean, they were just kids playing together, and one day someone came and took them away to this, you know, alien environment. And my mother would often tell me nobody ever explained anything to her, which was just really hard for a kid, you know. And I'm sure, you know, children typically, you know, blame themselves for things. And I'm sure she must have blamed herself. She must have thought, well, maybe I did something, I was naughty or so on. So I can imagine she really suffered terribly.
And the nuns were telling the children, like your mother, that they were dirty and lazy and that they needed to clean and clean some more. What effect did that psychological trauma have on your mom?
Well, and that was the thing. I think that was the worst for her and for a lot of people, being sent that message that you are a priori, as it were, wrong and bad, just as you are, and that you've got to correct that. That is that's a powerful message to send to people, and that message has been sent to a lot of Native people for generations, until relatively recently.
You write about your relationship with Bernice, your mother, and infrequent hugs, your mother's sharp corners of her elbows, and then, you know, starting out under the kitchen table when you were little, when she became unstable. What was this relationship like between you two, and how you learned about what your mother went through?
When I was really little, you know, I think she was probably more affectionate with me than she was with others, certainly with my brothers. But I, you know, learned with her that she was a very mercurial person. She would get, as she described it, nervous. And I always wondered what that felt like. But I could see she would get really wound up, and she would sort of pace back and forth and smoke Camel Straight cigarettes and drink black coffee and kind of mutter to herself and angrily about trying to really, I think, write over those negative messages that the nuns gave her. So, you know, when you're a child, you become a pretty quick read of adults around you, and you learn to stay out of the way and not attract attention if things are not going well.
And you're right how she threw her stories down before you like a gauntlet, a challenge, and kind of daring you, begging you to validate her and what she was saying. What was that like for you?
Well, that whole sort of gauntlet aspect, that came later when I was a child, when I was really little. I mean, these were like my bedtime stories. And usually she put rather a positive spin on them. You know, she was kind of the little girl who survived and was strong and defiant and prevailed. But later in life, you know, she would, you know, really communicate to me her disgust with the hypocrisy and her real, even though in many ways, you know, she invented her, reinvented herself as a church lady, if you will. It always stuck in her craw, you know, she was very ambivalent about it.
And she learned how to talk to white people at boarding school, which I found really fascinating. Like she learned how to read people and how to read these nuns. And she was then able to take that away and apply that to the white people who lived in her communities. Can you talk more about that?
And that may be among the most valuable lesson that Native people learned, children learned in boarding school, was how to navigate that world. What white people were threatened by, what made them, you know, what made things easier for the children. You know, they were able to figure out that culture, you know, that they had entered into. And that was in many ways, you know, they used that going forward if they, you know, were to live in the white world, which, you know, it was and it still is, you know, if you will, you know, white folks' world. And if you can't walk that walk and talk that talk, I think often you find you're not as successful as you could be.
Sister Catherine, who ran St. Mary's boarding school for so long, how did Sister Catherine treat children like your mother?
Well, she was, you know, it was interesting. I talked to some people, you know, as adults who knew her and were in school when she was there. And some people thought that she may have had, you know, some sort of mental illness. And in actually in defense of many of those nuns, I mean, they would often stay, you know, in these places 24/7 within the missions with children. And that's not healthy, really, if one thinks of it. And, you know, if the nuns became very, very ill or something, they would maybe, you know, let them go to, you know, to the hospital or so on. But, you know, it was a big deal to transfer, to leave. So you had to make do. And, you know, one can imagine that might have been really stressful. And, you know, I've heard a number of older folks, a number of elders talk about, you know, some of those nuns kind of went crazy.
And you find in the archives at Marquette University a photo and a letter from 1934 addressed to the head of the Bureau of Catholic Indian Missions. What was in the letter?
Well, it was basically a validation of a story my mother had told me my entire life. She told me about a Christmas Eve when Sister Mary Catherine was going down to the cellar and she fell down the stairs. And she, you know, was injured. And then several days later, she died. And my mom would tell me, oh, what a secret cheer us kids did. You know, it was the best Christmas present we ever got. And I didn't really take it at face value. You know, I thought she had embellished it. And as an adult, I went to the archives and I was looking through like the lists and so on of our children's names and some of the records that were available. And to be honest, they weren't very revealing. For instance, they didn't really have anything about the children's performance or their grades even. It was primarily the records were to, you know, they were ensured that they were paid, that the schools were paid, but the administrative correspondence turned out to be very rich. And I just totally stumbled on this letter that was written by the sister secretary to the Bureau of Catholic Indian Missions in Washington, D.C., basically, you know, essentially saying, you know, I regret to tell you that Sister Mary Catherine fell down the cellar steps and hit the bottom step with such force that she drove her glasses into her head and has been in a coma since, and we don't expect her to recover. And the language, it was, I know you'll pray for her in the suffering heart of Jesus. I don't know if those are the exact words, but I was seated in the archives by myself, reading at this at a big library table, and I read that, and I stood straight up out of my chair.
Because that was true story coming from your mother.
Yes, that is absolutely what happened. And then, and people in Odena do tell that story to this day.
Mary Annette Pember is with us, author of Medicine River, as we look at the history of Native American boarding schools and the impact on her own family. Mary, Bernice's little brother, Gerald, or he's called Rags, enters the boarding school at just 3 years old. What did Rags endure?
You know, I called up his son and his wife, and you know, they said that he didn't talk about it much, and he's gone now. Although they did say that he ran away when he was in eighth grade, but for a little guy, I mean, he was the youngest, and I think he was just, you know, sort of an extra mouth to feed. But he was this little dark guy. And, you know, the nuns were very impatient. And I mean, if you didn't obey, they would, you know, cuff you up, as they would say in those days. They would probably slap him. And at one point, you know, the food was not very good a lot of times. And of course, it was during the Depression, and it wasn't very good for a lot of people. But my mother recalled that the nuns fed them a dinner of stewed onions. And of course, the three-year-old was not too interested in eating that. And so he wouldn't eat it. And the nuns were trying to, you know, they held him down, and they were trying to force feed him these, you know, horrible, greasy, you know, onions. And so he was sputtering and coughing. And my uncle, my mother's elder brother, Don, he interceded, you know, and he pushed them away, and he's, you know, they backed him into a corner, my mother said, and he began swinging, and he hit one of the nuns like in the solar plexus and must have knocked the wind out of her and really shocked the nuns. And my mother would call that, you know, Don, actually my aunt later verified that it was in the winter, and Don like ran in his pajamas all the way from the school to her house and, you know, showed up at the door and told my grandmother, my great grandmother, what had happened. And she said, well, go to bed. And the next day she did go down to the school, and, you know, and as my auntie said, she gave that nun hell, but you know, there really wasn't too much that, you know, could be done. Certainly my great-grandma couldn't take them in. And the story was, and so after all of this happened and after Don left, that they nailed Uncle Rags to the table all night. Now, and I thought, and I remember thinking about that later, and I thought, well, surely they couldn't have actually nailed his body, I mean, through his hands or something. They must have nailed his clothing, but they must have used a lot of nails, right? I mean, otherwise he could have gotten away. And I thought of how frightening that must have been for him. And then the other kids listening to him cry, he must have cried quite late and just fallen asleep.
Can you take a moment and talk about your grandmother, Seal, who puts these children in it? Essentially to live at the boarding school. And you say that she chose survival over motherhood. What was her life like?
Well, when she was married to my grandfather, who was quite a bit older, he's about 10 years older, Joe Rabideau, and he had been in the First World War in the infantry and had survived a number of gas attacks. And probably, you know, were we to know Joe now, we would say that he had, you know, PTSD. And it was untreated, and he drank quite a bit, and he just was not able to do well. He wasn't able to provide. There were really no jobs anyway, and he kind of gave up, and he drank quite a bit, and he would fight with Seal, and she was known to have a big mouth. Seal was the oldest, that her voice could be heard from a great distance, and she would chew you out. And he came home, he'd been drinking all day, and he drank up all the little bit of money they had, and she just started unleashing on him and yelling at him. And he appeared like really, really drunk, but somehow he collected himself and he attacked her just viciously. And actually they were rolling on the ground, and he began biting into her, and he almost bit off one of her breasts. And my mother and Rags witnessed that. They were hiding under the kitchen table as this was all going on. And somehow Seal got to her feet, and she grabbed a beer bottle and she hit him over the head and knocked him out. And she was able to drag herself and the children over to her mother's house. And her mother was a midwife, and she doctored her. And afterwards, you know, she recovered, she didn't want to go back. But Seal it, you know, I mean, I can't imagine. Seal is just, it was like at that point, you know, it was personal survival.
Yeah.
You know, that was her choice. And she felt she had to save herself. And so she fled.
Since at least 2020, Congress has been considering the Indian Boarding School Policy Act, which would establish this investigative commission into our country's boarding school past. Where does this work stand now, and especially the idea of reparations?
Well, I have to say that I really don't think reparations will happen here. That's just my personal opinion. They happened in Canada, and that work began in 2007. The act did pass the Senate during the last administration, and the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is taking it up again. However, given the current climate, one wonders, you know, even if it is passed, I don't know, would it get vetoed? You know, President Trump just recently, I think it was last week, he clawed back the National Endowment for the Humanities, several grants for instance, the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition and some other tribal groups to conduct interviews and collect stories and do various projects. And it was like $1.5 million, but there were a lot of organizations that were going to benefit from that. And I think the wording was from the head of the agency that it no longer aligned with their current philosophies.
As we close, I want to ask you about healing and resilience, because you write about how that question misses the mark. And when we talk about the Native communities, what should people outside of Native communities be focused on instead of the question about resilience when it comes to this immense trauma?
Well, that we have, you know, we may, I think, in many ways represent one of the, you know, most incredible survival stories, both culturally and physically, you know, in mankind. If one thinks of how we have been able to preserve our culture and languages to the degree that we have, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, we look now that, you know, our population around the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, our population was about 250,000 had diminished to. And, you know, what is it now? I mean, it's like something like 2 million. And, you know, depending upon who gathers that data, it could, you know, it could arguably be quite a bit more. So people have, you know, worked really hard and, you know, worked with the federal government and, you know, passed things like the Self-Determination Act, which actually turned 50 this year, in which Native people have to be consulted about federal programming and monies that are spent on their communities. So Native people have survived. We're incredibly scrappy people, and we have been able to make do with what we had and even flourish. So, you know, I don't know, some of these words, they just really kind of pale, and I think fail to really give, you know, paint an adequate picture of how we have gone on and how we have ultimately thrived. But I think, you know, in many ways, and maintain our worldview in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think we, you know, we can serve as an inspiration for a lot of people.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
Mary Annette Pember's book is called Medicine River, A Story of Survival and the Legacy of Indian Boarding Schools. Mary is a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. We've been talking about the legacy of Native American boarding schools and their collective impact of trauma on families to this day.